Hello, this is episode number 40 of Jughead's Basement with lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. This month, 6 month, year, is with B-Face. B-Face and I were in a band called The Mopes together. He was in The Queers also and Groovy Ghoulies, and I was in Screeching Weasel during that time. He's been in a lot of other bands, but we mostly just got together to talk, him in Boston, me in Japan, just to talk about whatever came to our minds at the time. I had a few questions written down that I wanted to ask him, but for the most part, we just sort of chatted for about an hour and 10 minutes. I really appreciate him allowing me to do this with him. We predominantly talk about the Mopes because I have lost a lot of memories about our time together with the Mopes. So this was really sort of an opportunity for me to explore a person, B-Face, who has been a big part of my musical life, and a lot of those memories have gone away. So it was really nice to get to sort of chat with him for about an hour and 10 minutes. So I'm not going to add any music. Here it is, just me and him chatting. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, there we go. We got it. I found it.
It shows.
Yay!
On my
end.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It shows on your end, too, if it's recording?
Yeah, it says at the top is a little red dot. It says, John is recording the call.
Oh. Oh, that's. I guess that's polite.
Yes, it is. So the other person knows, definitely.
So thanks for doing this. With the Jughead's Basement, I get so in depth with the records that I do. So sometimes they take months to, sometimes like 6 months to do. So I started doing these more simple, more spontaneous. So I call them more like dual interviews because they're more like conversations. And if I ask you something, and if you have a question for me, you know, we just go back and forth. So it's more like of a conversation than it is an interview.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, I think, to listen to. So,
yeah, cool. So let's just do that.
Yeah, definitely.
I did write down a few things here, but if they inspire, like I said, if they inspire something else, some direction you want to take them, that's fine with me too.
Okay, cool.
But my memory in terms of a lot of our crossover history, for some reason, is very vague. I don't know why that is. Like, I remember we first met probably at that queer show at Joe's place, right?
At the farmhouse, yeah, yeah. That was I want to say that was late 91 because it was a New Year's Eve show. And I think it was 91 into 92.
Right, and that's when he had the, what's the restaurant? In my mind, it's all like in one place, but the restaurant, was that a separate place, or was that actually like within walking distance or in the same place as his, where we did
the
show?
No, it's a short drive. It's the farmhouse was on Route 1 in Northampton, and then the restaurant was in Exeter, which borders Hampton, so to go from one to the other probably was not even 10 minutes, maybe 10 tops driving.
Yeah.
But I forgot that you guys went there.
Yeah, I think that's where we actually met him. I think we went to the restaurant first, Joe's place, because I still have somewhere in my collection of stuff. I have his paper, you know, plates, not plates. What do they call those things? The, you know, where you put your food on the, like a little paper.
Oh, like a tray?
Yeah, a little tray, paper plate, a tray he had for his place. So.
What I remember specifically is meeting you guys at the toll booth on 95. I don't know if that was done. There were no cell phones, so if you guys called, it must have been from a payphone. And I remember because I hopped out and Gubb was the first guy I saw, which was funny because he wasn't. I think he was just filling in, and I was like, "Is that Jughead, man? They don't look anything like that." But so anyway, so you guys followed us, and I think it's all coming together. I think we went straight from there to the restaurant, and Joe made like late night tostadas.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah, it was something that he made for us. But you're right. Yeah, it was late that that night. It was all that. Maybe that's why it leads to it being kind of a blur to me, because a lot of that tour was just pulling into a place late at night. And
well, not only that, but I mean, you guys really weren't there that long. I mean, that show kind of looms large in my mind because it's when I met you guys. But I swear, you guys, so you stay that night, and then the next day was the party and show, or the next night, and then you were gone. I think you left January 1st.
Yeah, that's probably why. I mean, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're so quick.
The only other thing I remember. Go ahead.
No, I maybe we're saying the same thing. The things I remember from that night are, it was in the basement, right? The show was in the basement, but we sort of hung out more in the upstairs area. And I remember Joe was sort of playing his guitar a lot and writing, you know, like spontaneous songs. And then, of course, there's that story of the guy who was huffing butane that's become like legendary for that.
Yeah, he was huffing butane. And if I remember, he was exhaling onto a lighter.
Yes.
And that, yeah, you're right. That house is over 100 years old. And the curtains, I think, were probably from the 1930s or 40s. And so that he ended up getting kicked out. That was dangerous. That was not good. But yeah, I remember Joe walking around, because I think he was inspired just by your presence. And he was walking around singing he would make up little blurbs or something like that. And you're right, the show was in the basement. But because it was a very small area, the whole party was upstairs.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that's why I don't remember much of the downstairs area. I don't even remember playing, but I do remember hanging out in the upstairs area and with you guys.
Did you know it was recorded?
No. Is that like online?
No. I don't know whatever happened to it. It only occurred to me the other day when I was thinking ahead about having this conversation. I was like, we had gone. I remember the building we went to. There was a guy that Joe went, and I think he wanted to rent a PA from the guy. And he ended up, the guy was at the show working that along. And then we just never, we just fell out of touch with the guy. I don't think it exists anywhere.
Wow. So you have a memory of that, just of it being talked about, but you never actually saw the video itself?
I saw the videotape. I think Joe must have had a copy of it.
Oh, yeah, wow. I'd like
remember
to
seeing it. Yeah.
Those, you know, to be honest, those are really great memories, but they're so vague in my head. I wouldn't mind seeing. I don't like looking at old videos of the band that much, yeah. But only ones that sort of will help me refresh memories and what places looked like. So I'd be really interested in seeing that one.
I'll try and find it. The guy, I went past the building, probably a year or two ago, and the guy's long gone, and he was much older than us at the time. Anyways, he wasn't part of anything, any music scene or anything. He just rented a gear, but Joe definitely had, or one of us, I don't think I did, but someone had a copy of the videotape, because I remember seeing it, and the way I can picture how the stage was only lit by a single light. And, and Ben, I remember specifically Ben had blue hair, because you could see, because the majority of the light was in the center of the stage, and that really stood out. So yeah, it absolutely exists. Go ahead.
I recently reheard a WFMU, because we recorded at WFMU on that tour too, which was around the same time. And I was actually honestly surprised how great we sounded. I know that's kind of, I don't know, self congratulatory, but I was really surprised. It I don't know.
That's,
I don't know, those
nice
days,
huh?
I don't know, but those days you just think, you know, we're a punk band and we're just doing this stupid thing and we're, you know, learning these songs, we're passionate about it. But when I listened to it, it was actually very well, like, we were very well rehearsed.
Yeah, I mean, you do it so much. I mean, at that time you're playing the same songs again. I'm sure you guys practiced the hell, or at least practiced some, you know, before the tour. Yeah. And then you're doing it every night.
Yeah.
I think you guys actually recorded the very next night, because I remember getting a call, or maybe it was January 2nd, but we got a call from you guys down in the New York, Jersey area, because Vapid had left his laundry behind.
I remember.
So we ended up mailing that to him, but I'm pretty darn sure. And you guys did 2 7-inches, I think, from that recording, or maybe just the recording was on one of 2 7-inches.
Yeah, I think it's on one of the 7-inches, and I don't know. I never. It's weird. I mean, there was a while there where we put out so many 7-inches that I wasn't even really listening to them. I was just throwing them in my collection, so I don't even know if I heard it. But I think it was some sort of WFMU anniversary where he went into his archives and he pulled out all these cassettes of old recordings, and he did ours, and then it now it's online. It lives online now.
Oh, so you mean that you didn't just hear the 7-inch, you heard the entire recording.
Yeah. Yeah. The guy, I can't remember the guy who did it, but many years ago, I think some anniversary, he took all his cassettes and he turned them digitally and he released them online.
Oh,
so I just heard it like a couple weeks or like a few months ago, actually.
Wow. All right. Cool. Yeah. Was Ben playing? Yeah. Ben was playing guitar on that.
Yeah, because that's must have been when we were touring for Wiggle then, because that means if Gub was with us, that's because John Stockfish wasn't touring.
Oh, maybe. I thought Wiggle came out after that. Because I remember, the Genie Has a Problem with Their Uterus is on Wiggle, correct?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That Basement show. So I don't know.
Yeah, it might not have been released yet, but we were, I think we had just done recording it, and then, because John Stockfish was in the band, because Gub was never actually technically in the band, he was just touring for John Stockfish at the
time.
Oh,
I see, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, that's cool, now I gotta find that that FMO thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send you a link to it, I'll write a little note here. I was surprised how good it was. I think we talked about this in the podcast for Don't Back Down, but how long had you been with Joe when we had met?
That would have been about a year and a half, closer to 2 years, actually.
Okay, so it was fairly long time then.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, I guess, but yeah, I think I joined in May of 90, so that was... I'm pretty sure it was 91, the very end of 91. Because I was, when I went, we went out there and played with you guys at McGregor's in March, I want to say of 92, and I had just turned 21. I remember that. So if McGregor's was after that New Year's show, then it was definitely the end of 91.
Yeah. Wow. We were just babies.
Yep.
Hey, this is I want to throw this one out there, but this is we're not doing any kind of timeline, so I'm just skipping around, but I've been thinking about this a lot. Often I feel like often you and I and a couple others are sort of referred to as the nice guys of the punk scene. But it seems like we've also often been paired up with some, you know, like the genius assholes of the scene.
Yeah,
I think that's an interesting yeah. Do you often think about that, or do people often ask you about that? I mean, I think you and I are fairly nice guys. I mean, even the business we just did today with the Mope stuff, it was so laid back. You know, we had to figure out a royalty, and it was just like so laid back. But that isn't the way it is with a lot of the band members. But
no, well, I think you have to put things in context. I'm not going to get worried about something like that. No, you know what my biggest struggle has been with being considered an asshole, but, you know, by people who don't know me. So I don't know if I've ever really been known as a nice guy.
Really? You think people have considered you an asshole?
Well, I was pretty stoic when I first met you guys. I didn't talk a lot. I shouldn't say not a lot. Probably I. At the party and stuff, I'd get a few in me and stuff, but yeah, I don't know, something about how I stand on stage. I've been told so many times that people didn't want to talk to me because they thought I was going to be a jerk to them just because of how I looked. That's been going on for years. I've heard that for a long time.
Well, I would get that too personally. Like, I mean, people didn't know me. Like, even my girlfriends have said that I look like, you know, I'm someone that doesn't want to be talked to. So maybe we have that in common too, but I don't know. I just always assumed that you were considered one of the other, you know, nice guys in the scene. And
well, Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I never picked up on the fact, like, you never gave me that impression that you didn't want to talk to anyone.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just weird. It goes to show, you know, you never know how you're perceived, and we're often surprised when we hear, you know, like I said, what I'd hear about me, I'd be like, Jesus, I'm not that bad.
Yeah. Well, my other thing is that in those days, I just wasn't as interested in being like the person out front there. So I just felt like I didn't really, I think I talked to Jeff Ott about this, you know, Jeff from Grim Shrine, that,
yeah,
the podcast I did with him, and that I just feel like I didn't really, you know, I mean, Ben was such the, you know, loved the attention. So I didn't have to worry about that. So I felt like I didn't really start learning about the people that I was in a scene with until years afterwards, until I started doing my podcast and just getting to know people years later. It's just an interesting thing. Like, I don't know what was really going on with me while the things were going on.
Well, I mean, if you're in a band with someone who's that gregarious, you got Ben, who's, he pretty much spoke for the band, and you know, you, any conversations you might have would generally be off to the side or stuff like that.
Yeah, and yeah, in general, I always seemed like I was more interested in talking to the audience. I was always the one that's, like me and Panic too, that was more interested in talking to like fans or just people than schmoozing with other bands or,
yes,
you know, trying,
yes,
to be some sort of attention, you know,
right,
grabber.
Right. I tend to, at shows or even a party or something, I'll latch onto a single person and that'll be my conversation for an hour. I don't need to go from person to person or anything. But, you know, as far as that, you know, being in the not wanting to be in the front or anything like that, I mean, I wonder if, well, for you actually, because you did theater anyway, so you probably had enough of that anyways.
Yeah, I didn't really. Yeah, that was nice for me. And I think that's why Ben and I got along for a long time, is that I didn't really feel any need to be a front man in the bands, because I, you know, I was dealing. Yeah, I was in theater and I had my other life going on, so
yeah,
it was, I felt like more of a support in general.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's totally how, that's actually what I love about playing bass, is it's nothing about it is out front, and it's almost, at times I felt kind of like a weird behind the scenes sort of person, like, you know, the instrument itself is not out front, and but it a bass line can really change the whole entire feel of a song. So it's kind of been a secret kind of little enjoyment of mine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like, to get into the psychology of that. I mean, I see that about you, and I see that about bass players, but you've quite a history with music, like an important figure sort of in the punk scene. Does that sit well with you, having to be more of the background fella?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, I would. Yeah. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Huh.
I mean, as fun as I love, you know, playing and stuff. I never feel the need to be, you know, eyes on me. Definitely not. I don't know. I'm very happy playing the bass. I'm one of the few people I know that prefer bass over guitar. A lot of people who do both would always want guitar. I don't know why, but. But yeah, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, no, I've actually, luckily through the podcast, have interviewed quite a few bass players that bass playing is what they do. And I really admire someone who just goes, no, that's what I want to do, you know, because there's a lot. It's when you really take bass playing seriously, it's quite an important instrument. You know, it's if you hook up with the drummer and, you know, you're the foundation of what actually makes a song sound good, like sonically.
Yeah, and it's also, if you hook up with the drummer, which you should. I mean, it took me a couple of years to figure that out. We had to work together. It used to be I just started out playing, you know, Ramon style. I would just exactly follow the guitar. But once you get going on, you know, you can figure that stuff out. You can if you work with the drummer, the tiniest little things that you come up with can really it's almost subliminal. I mean, a friend of mine said a good bass player should be felt and not heard. And I thought that was perfect. It's like, it really is kind of under like subliminal behind the scenes, almost sort of thing. I don't think, you know, bass is, when you listen to a song, you don't focus on the bass, or at least if you do, then it's, I don't know, it's distracting, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's a power play. It's a secret power play. I think your bass player has all the power, you know, but it's, of course it doesn't.
Huh. What's this? Now that leads me to the Mopes, which I don't know why. You know, the Mopes to me are this strange little thing that we all have going on. You know,
yes.
you, me, and Vapid mostly, but you know, Lumley is there in the background, whatever drummer we can get, but
right.
But it's sort of like something that, I don't know, is like cushy, like important to me. Like it's a little comfort thing I have in my past, and knowing that we just get along, but we don't take anything seriously. And we haven't even recorded in years and years and years, but I still feel like we are a group of people. Does that make any sense?
It makes perfect sense. And it's something that was, to me, was unexpected. Which, you know, when you don't plan this sort of thing out, then it, and if it happens, then you know it's solid, you know? The first, the EP was, you know, we did. And then when we did the record, that's when it kind of clicked to me. I was like, oh, this is, the EP, it was almost an anomaly to me. It was just like, let's do this, let's have fun, and that's it. And then with the record, you guys had laid down some tracks. I came in a little late and I did it. And I was like, holy crap. I mean, this could be a thing. But it never became a thing. And which is another reason why I wonder why I personally hold it in, like, to me, it means a lot to me, because it was never a job or anything. It was just an enjoyable thing. And how lucky are we that other people ended up enjoying it? Because we could go do a show, you know, and hopefully some people would at least show up. So it's cool.
Yeah, I think that's the same way. Like I actually put more thought into the Mopes than I probably should in general in my life, just because of it has a weird contradiction. Like it's one of the, that Accident Waiting to Happen is probably the one of the best albums I've ever been on. And
yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But yet I also understand and respect this idea that we don't ever really consider it a band. But part of you also, or me, as in the you, wants to go like, oh, we could do more of that. But then it would take away from what it is, you know.
It doesn't seem like something you want to overdo. That said, I'm dying to do one, man. But we could talk about that a different time.
Yeah. Now, I know that in the in some sort of you know, some of the online wikis and stuff about the Mopes, it talks about and maybe it's because whoever set the perspective in the beginning talks about you and Vapid working on stuff, but simultaneously Vapid and I in my place were working on other things too.
Right, right.
So it was sort of a coming together of, well, around Vapid, of course, but you had been just goofing around with him, and I had been goofing around with him too. So I only know about my part of it, but what was your part of it? What did you bring to that first Mopes anomaly?
Well, we had written two songs, but they were goofy songs. We didn't take them seriously when he was with the Queers, and so we just kind of, what those ended up being, it was Hairball and You Look Like a Gorilla, and that's all it was. It was just those two songs. He was in the Queers at the time, and we would have time, like, we wrote them in Kansas City, and then we played them just while partying. You remember Stacy and Jennifer? They're from Alabama. They came up for that McGregor show. I think you guys, Stacy might have had promoted a show for you guys in Birmingham.
Yeah, I do remember them because I met her years later. She had moved to like a small town. She was a writer, one of them. I think it was Stacy or something.
Yeah, probably Stacy. I lost track of both of them, but they when they moved from Alabama, they lived together in Berkeley with I think I remember it being a big house with a bunch of people. One of the guys from Mop Ivy, the drummer, I think lived there. But anyway, so we were staying there because the queers were in the area for, you know, 4 or 5 days. And we ended up playing those songs, just fooling around. And both Stacy and Jennifer and a couple of the guys that were there were like, that's right there. Do it. And of course, everyone's drinking, they're smoking weed. So how seriously can you take it?
Yeah.
But they were urging us. So that kind of made the songs kind of locked into the back of my head. Like, okay, there's, you know, they're goofy, but we're never going to do anything with them because there was no option. And then Vapid, this is probably a year or two, maybe a couple of years later, said that he had been practicing with you just two guitars and messing around.
Yeah.
And I think he wanted to bring it all together. But as far as what I brought, it was just originally those first two songs.
Yeah, we had been working on the Loopy Cockatoo was the one,
yes.
one that yes. we were fooling around with. And then we all sort of wrote Wipe Out on the Dunes together, I think, in when we got together. Now, this is where it gets really, you know, I know more. I have more actually solid memories of Accident Waiting to Happen than I do. I just forgot the name of it. Lowdown Two-Bit Sidewinder.
Yes.
That's it. Yeah. Yes. Did we, there was some kind of weird space we met in, right? With Lumley. Like
yes.
I remember it being like a really, really echoey room. Where were we?
That was, I want to say that was Dan's brother's rehearsal space. What was his name? Mike, I think.
Mike. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If it wasn't his space, he hooked us up with it because he was definitely there. When we were trying to get a clean, he was setting up the amp. And I remember Vapid, you know, his brother's a metalhead and he had this whole chugga chugga thing going. And Vapid said, well, I kind of want to get a kind of a cleaner sound. So I remember Mike just stepped on a bunch of pedals and shut them all off. And then he started playing this like really sweet Led Zeppelin riff. And it just made me cry. I was laughing out loud, but it worked. But it's funny that your memories are hazy on that one because mine are completely hazy on Accident Waiting to Happen. I think mainly because I just kind of came in for that after you guys had already laid down a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, you came in pretty fast there. I think it's just because I don't know. There's something about Mass Giorgini's, you know, Sonic Iguana that like I can sort of pinpoint memories better.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
We did both there, but I don't. It's so weird. I mean, I don't know why the Mopes is like, its memory is just so strange to me. I don't know why that a lot of that is just gone.
Well, you know, like, what, you know what just occurred to me while you were saying about the space? We didn't write Wipe Out on the Dunes at that space. We wrote it the very next day sitting around in, I want to say it was your, yes, it was your apartment. And Lumley, was playing on maybe some boxes or a record covers or something. So that was never actually worked out until, well, that day. I think we went into the studio. We drove down to Indiana either that day or the next day. And so that a lot of that was written right in the studio.
Yeah, yeah, I know. That's what I think. I mean, I think they're all charming in their own way. I mean, Accident Waiting to Heaven, of course, is like a record. But that first one, I just, when I listen to it, it just makes me smile because they're so goofy and stupid. But I, you know, the other thing I remember, and there's a picture of it, which helps me, always helps me remember, is when we went to do the backgrounds for You Look Like a Gorilla. And I remember it felt like we were like on this religious, weird, trippy thing where we were just saying Ungawa, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we were saying?
Yes. Yes, that was Lumley's addition. I don't remember what we were doing. We were trying to come up with some sort of going to fill it out somehow. And we came up with a drum beat where he does this massive kind of floor tom boom. And then we had to counteract that with something. And it was, and Lumley said, yeah, they used to say it on the old Tarzan movies. and so, yeah, we just said Ungawa. And we just, I remember when we were mixing it. just messing around, Mass kind of boosted the Ungawas, and it sounded just like, holy crap. Because there was a lot of voices just doing, you know, this really low thing. It was insane.
Yeah. But, no, that's, I guess that is another memory I keep in my head of actually recording that. Cause I remember in the room, it just, it was one of those, I don't know, those strange things where you repeat something over and over again. And there's a group of people that are usually goofy that are really concentrated, and it just sort of sends you into a different headspace.
Yeah. That's what kind of experience. It took a few tries because we were laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you just sit there and say Ungawa and just not, I mean, that session, actually, I remember that I laughed more during that. It was probably a 2-day session. It wasn't very long. I laughed more than any other recording session ever. And
yeah,
definitely. Well, doing the Ungawas was part of that.
Yeah. Well, I remember part of, I mean, I think Do the Hairball had most of the lyrics done, but I do remember some of it, you know, watching Vapid doing these funny movements. And we were, I think, coming up with some of the lyrics right there.
Oh, that could be. Yeah, GQ. I don't remember. But I remember because we were trying to keep it in the vein of it reminded me of Surfin' Bird.
Vapid
would kind of make those, you know, the noises and gestures and stuff. And yeah, it was hilarious, man. It really was. But then there was a couple there like that you guys wrote completely that I had nothing to do with, like Hula Hoop and Squeaky Clean. I don't think I had anything to do with that.
Yeah, well, Squeaky Clean, I think, was Vapid's on his own.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I didn't write anything on that. I just, him and I do the corresponding sort of chord solos at the end, but he had created that one. But right. Yeah, Hula Hoop and Loopy Cockatoo were the two that we had worked on beforehand.
I saw you post something, this is some months back, but which song was it that you said was CCR influenced, or your guitar part was?
That was Loopy Cockatoo. Yeah. That's I say CCR, but it's actually CCR's version of an older song. What is it? I actually posted it then. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Good Golly Miss Molly. It's Good Golly Miss Molly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Loopy. So that's the main riff you're saying.
Yeah. And then Wipeout on the Dunes for me was my sort of weird take on the Devo song on the first record, where it turns from one song into a different song. I forgot the name of it.
Oh, yeah.
Something feeling.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, your guitar on that.
Yeah. So that was sort of the idea behind that one, is that it would just be a song that turned into a different song and never really becomes an actual song, you know, because it's basically a chorus that,
right,
and that's it.
Yeah, that's what's weird about that song, is it doesn't, it's not normal.
Yeah.
You know? But well, that's funny. So we got Devo and CCR in there, and well, and the Trash Men. That's, and I guess that's,
well, do the hair, yeah, just like Do the Hairball. No, Do the Hairball is like, yeah, definitely old school stuff,
and the Look Like a Gorilla riff was also that was, I got that from a Trog song called Your Love, which it's not exactly the same, but it's definitely influenced by that.
Yeah.
I don't remember what album it's on, but it was a matter of fact, actually, at the time, I think I'd gotten it from the Mummy's version, but it's different. But I'm just trying to think of the different influences on that.
Yeah.
EP.
Another thing about the Mopes that I do carry over to even in Blackouts, is that it didn't really matter who was doing what in the Mopes. Like, you know, speaking of you Look Like a Gorilla, you did the acoustic on that.
Right.
And
yeah,
you did a bunch of the solos on both of the records. It's one of those things, again, I don't think, because there's no pressure really of us being a band and worrying about royalties and worrying about, you know, everything else. We just went in there and did it. So I didn't care if you played a part or if I played it. It didn't matter.
Yeah. I never even thought about anything like that. I just remember doing, cause the Hairball, the lead was already written, and I don't remember on the album. I guess Dan had sent me a cassette of most of the songs And I guess he wanted me to, I just came up with a lead or two. I don't remember, actually. That one's kind of hazy to me. But yeah, it didn't matter. It's just like, you know, whoever do whatever.
Yeah, I'm looking up accident waiting to happen now because I figure that's where we'll go till next. So I'm looking up on the internet so I can remember what songs.
Oh, the songs, yeah. That was another mix of, there was a couple little kind of Western influence amongst this just pretty much straight up pop punk. Cause the instrumentals were kind of surfy, Western-y sounding and to me it sounds perfectly fine, but I've heard people say they kind of didn't care for that.
Yeah. See, I would disagree with that. I feel like that's the whole weird backbone of that band is
I agree.
Ability to do that. I think it would just be, yeah, like a regular pop punk record if it didn't have that weird influence in it.
I'm nodding as you talk. That's exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. But that's what some people want. But
I mean, I just think, I just love supporting Vap. That's this, you know. I mean, it was all of us, but a lot of it was, I think. I don't know. I pick these certain people out. I do it in theater too, where I'm just really happy to really make this person shine. And I there's just some great stuff Vapid was doing during that time.
Oh, tons of it. Tons yeah. of stuff. Yeah. I mean, he was on a writing like, well, I mean, from what I know from, you know, I live 1,000 miles away, but we would talk and, you know, I would hear tapes and stuff, but yeah, I'm with you. I mean, Vapid isn't the one to, he's not going to go around and yell and toot his own horn and talk about himself. So it's like I'm with you. I'm like, let's back this dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's just, he has a natural, even for the solos on like, even on 1850 or any of that stuff, he just has a natural inclination to just feel that groove. You know, remember when that, I don't know what show it was. It wasn't the last one for my birthday. I think it might have been the one before that. It might have been the birthday. But whenever we get together, it's just so – it happens so quickly, you know.
Yes.
We don't have a lot of time, but it doesn't feel like it needs a lot of time to get it back into shape.
Right, right. Definitely, yeah. Which is good. And there's a couple things I still get stuck on. I don't remember one of the instrumentals. I just, for the life of me, have so much trouble with it. I can't remember which one, though.
I think that one was, it's either Recall or 1850. It does something kind of strange. And I always have trouble with Tell Me, because it's like a reverse pattern of a lot of regular pop punk songs.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I've messed that one up a bunch myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the instrumental is a key change that Dan threw in there, and it's most key changes I've ever dealt with have just been going up a step or whatever, and this is just changes oddly, but it's friggin' genius, man. It's great, mm-hmm. great sound, great change. I mean,
yeah. Now I'm gonna go into. I'm trying to think. I don't have many more. Maybe I don't have as many memories for Accident Waiting to Happen either, I guess. I do remember that I think we used the Celdanos, and I wasn't sold on it, but I think Mass had at least me use it. I think Vapid probably too, but that guitar sound on that record is probably one of the strongest too that I've yeah. played on. Like, there's something really... great sounding about it, like the muting and the open strings.
Are you talking about on the EP or on
Accident Waiting to Happen?
Okay, the record, yeah. I don't remember what was on the EP. It was kind of a different sound on that. I remember you had your Gibson,
yeah.
But yeah, the Soldanos I think were fairly new to him at the time, and I didn't know if you both used them.
I'm not sure. It doesn't make sense that we would both use them because I think Mass likes to mix it up a bit. And
yes, I mean,
maybe I used it or he used it. I don't. I'm not sure.
Oh, you know what I think it was. You had your Gibson, that SG.
Yeah.
and which has a humbucker in it. I think that went through the Soldano for it's a much kind of meatier, fuller sound. And Vapid had some sort of Strat with a kind of a little more punchy sound. And so he might have played through a different amp, like a Fender or something. I don't remember, though.
Yeah.
He'd know. I wish. Yeah. I don't remember.
You actually even know better than I do about that stuff. I don't know. But I think that makes sense. I think I was less caring about what I used. But I remember once once the Soldano was used on that, it made a difference. Like,
yeah,
even on I Don't Know How to Say Goodbye, the muting that I do or mm-hmm. something, it just sounded really strong.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, that's one thing is Mass knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, when in doubt, listen to him, you know.
Then, you know, what got weird for me was, and I think I've talked about, I've never actually done it in like speaking to someone or to you guys about it, but when Vapid approached us with the stuff that eventually ended up being the Methadones, I remember that's where we didn't really have a falling out, but that was where I got the stuff from him and I was like, and he was like, well, this is a little bit different. So maybe we should call it something different. And I think I was really frustrated with Weasel at the time. So I was like, well, I'd rather do something like as a band and just call it the Mopes. And
yeah, I don't remember the circumstances. I remember wanting, as far as that record goes, I really wanted to do it because two of the songs, one of them didn't make it on the record, but were old songs that, again, Vapid and I would play. He wrote them, but we would play just sitting around on tour or in between shows or something. So that's what I remember about that is I was gung-ho about doing it. But I think whatever happened with your lack of involvement, what I wasn't there for, so I don't really know much about it.
Yeah, it was pretty much just why I don't mind talking about this stuff is because we all still get along so great now. It's like it's no big deal to me. But right. At the time, it was like I remember we were on the phone and I had said to him, I really said at the end of the conversation, well, I'm not going to do it then, because I just was convinced that we should be doing something as a band. And now in retrospect, I'm like, well, it doesn't really matter because something cool about the Mopes is that we weren't really ever considered a band. But I know that Vapid wanted to he wanted to call it something different. And that's where I bowed out.
Yeah, that which kind of makes sense because why it's almost like starting anew. And, you know, why do that if you don't have to?
Yeah.
And plus, I think at that point it was going to be the exact same lineup if you were involved, correct?
It would have been, yeah. It would have been all four of us again, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because I know Lumley played on it. So, yeah, yeah. Who knows? It all works out for the best.
Yeah. No, I bring that up also because someone actually had asked about that. And I was surprised how many, a lot of people didn't know what that first Methadones record was. So it came out in many ways out of the Mopes. I mean, it was,
definitely.
Once again, it was a brainchild of Vapid, but the idea that it was that it would prolong this idea of the Mopes records.
Well, it's directly from the Mopes. I mean, one goes straight into the other as far as the only change, your lack of involvement, but also is just the sort of the sound, basically the type of stuff. It's not really that kind of love song-y poppy stuff. And it doesn't, I don't remember it having any of the instrumentals either. So it's definitely not a Mopes record, but it came directly from what I recall. It was going to be another Mopes session.
Yeah, that's what it was. And then I dropped out of it, but Vapid was already moving towards, and this makes sense as the main creator. He was like this. He probably said to himself, this just doesn't sound like what we were doing before. So we should just call it something other. And that's where we sort of disagree. That's where we sort of disagree, because I felt like if we all got together, we would turn it into something that would be Mopes-ish.
Right. Well, yeah, that's kind of, yeah, you wouldn't be able to help that happening.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that was sort of his transition. It probably wasn't intentional at the time, but it was his transition to starting an actual active band, which was what the Methadones became. So it's weird. It's like he had the version of the Methadones back in the early 90s, but the methadones, you know, as most people know them, sort of grew out of the mopes.
Yeah.
Strange how it happens.
Yeah, no, I agree too.
Because it's not, the methadones are not associated with the mopes, aside from, I think, Dan's involvement. But it definitely came right straight from it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, there we did. We talked about it.
I'm trying to think of what else is on that album that worth talking.
Well, I mean, well, some of them are just straight, great, you know, vapid writing. My Heart Won't Bleed for You.
Yep, yep.
Baby Doll, I think he already had. I think, did you work on that with him earlier or something before that? I know that he had been working on that one before.
No, I did the lead for that, but he sent me a tape of it. So he already had that as a song, definitely.
Yeah, I think the only ones that we really came up with in the moment, which I still think are a lot of fun to me, was She Fell for Me.
Yes.
We came up in the studio. And Glad You're Gone, parts of that we came up with there. And I wrote Hang 'em 10 High.
Okay.
And then he did 1850 and Recoil.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you wrote Hang 'em 10 High. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So She Fell for Me, I remember you guys had written and put down the tracks for it the night before I showed up. So I just basically, I played the bass. I had nothing to do with writing that aside from my bass parts. That was you guys.
Yeah, we actually came up with the words in the studio for that one.
Oh, that's right. I do remember being there for that. I don't know if I don't think I contributed, but I remember that.
Yeah.
There was one or two, I know Mass plays some of those tracks, some of those songs I don't even play on.
There's two that he had played on, I think. I can't remember. Was it I Don't Know How to Say Goodbye? I think maybe Mass might have played that part.
Maybe. I know, I'm almost positive he played on the first song, My Heart Won't Bleed for You.
Yeah, so might have been those two.
Okay. What's this? There's a really slow one, Not a Word.
Not a Word, yeah. I love that song. See, I always told him it sounded like Velvet Underground, and Vapid didn't know what I was talking about then, but it still, to me, sounds like a very...
It does. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, that vibe is definitely...
Lou Reed sort of song there.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if I might not play on that either. I should have gone over this stuff. I didn't think of it, but...
Actually, it says right here. No, it doesn't matter. Like I said, this is all nitpick. But that was, yeah, it says right here, Not a Word was Master Genie. If okay. I could believe this Discogs. That's the only one. I know there was more than that. There was Lumley, but that was Mass. But that's the only one that's actually listed as Mass.
Oh, no kidding. Because I'm damn near positive that he played on My Heart Won't Bleed for You.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. But it's not in the lore of the Discogs.
Oh, well then that changes everything.
Oh, and yeah, and Lumley was on tambourine. So that's basically what Discogs says about Not a Word. So
is there no drums on that? I can't even remember.
No, it kicks in. I think I'm pretty sure it kicks in on drums at the end of it.
It does. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So but I assume that's Lumley on that as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Oh, boy. Lost in the mists of time.
I have this funny question that has nothing to do with any of that, but let's see where this goes, see what it means. I wrote it earlier while I was sitting on a mountain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. God, I've been seeing your posts, man. They're freaking crazy.
Yeah, I'm a little bit tired of being in Japan, working in Japan. So whenever I'm not working, I have 2 days off a week. I try to do what I can to get out of Osaka and just sort of hike a lot. So, and I've really been getting into photography lately. Like I feel like I have some sort of eye for capturing nice images. So
no doubt about that. I'm new to Instagram, but I've been seeing them, and it's holy crap. just beautiful stuff, man.
Yeah, and in Japan in general, it's pretty easy to shoot because there's just so much. They care so much about, you know, the environment in itself. So
right.
Everything is pretty well taken care of.
So you're living in Osaka?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here for 13 months this time around. So
that's awesome, man.
It is pretty cool. I miss home a lot right now, but I can't complain. It's a really cool place to live.
Yeah. God.
Yeah. There's two things I have. One is, and there might not be any kind of response to this, but it's always been cool whenever I reach out to you that you and I seem to be the ones that are always willing to just say yes to doing something, like without even really thinking about it too much. What do you think what's up with that?
I just love doing stuff. I mean, be it recording or you're talking just in music related, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with my relation with you is mostly with the most, but I got the feeling that if, you know, something I had that came through, you would, if you could, you would do it. It just seems absolutely like your way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd never do something I thought sucked or anything like that. But I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the more the merrier. You know, I don't like to think of myself in a little box where, well, maybe I shouldn't do that because, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But
there's reality. Do you find yourself saying yes to something before you even figured out whether you could possibly make it happen, and then you just make it happen? Or what?
No, not so much anymore, because that's gotten me in trouble before. Yeah. You know, I said yes. I was trying to juggle the Groovy Ghoulies and the Real Kids at once, and that created probably one of the worst times of my life. You know, just saying, you know, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Because I learned the hard way, you can't always make it happen. So to answer your question, I used to do that more now. Now I have a little book that I, you know, write down all my scheduling in, and so that nothing clashes and anything like that. But if I can do something, I will, you know, provided of course I have no huge aversion to doing it, but, yeah, playing creative wise, art, anything like that, I generally say yes, unless I have a really good reason not to.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel I'm the same way too. I just want, it's always about moving forward and just, I don't know, playing. I don't get to play as much as I would like to in general, music-wise. So it's I pretty much always say yes to opportunities like that.
Yeah, but I mean but you got a whole nother, like a career going, so it's probably a little difficult to do both.
Yeah, it is.
You know, what do you say, you know, how do you say yes to something if you're not even sure? You probably have... like you just said, you're 13 months in Japan this time. So that kind of, you can't do anything music-wise unless you do it over there now.
That is true. I'm actually flying out to, you know, the D-Cracks have this sort of birthday party for Matt, who's in the band. And they wanted me to do that this year in September. So I'm flying out to Vienna for that. But I basically have to do one day of travel there, then I'm there 2 days, and then one day of travel back.
Yikes.
Yeah. So
does
it's
that,
be a quick turnaround.
Does that affect what you're doing in Japan? Did you have to ask for a day off or anything?
Well, what I get 2 days off a week, but what you can do is you have to find another wizard who, you know, because I work with wizards, and I have to find, I have to find one that is willing to give me their 2 days and I give him my 2 days of the following week. Does that make sense?
Oh,
so basically
yeah.
You have to work like 10 days in a row and then you get 4 days off and then they do the same thing.
I see. Yeah.
Otherwise you just have 2 days a week off. So,
okay.
Yeah. It's a lot harder to plan. That's why I tend to just on my days off, I just go off on my own. That's why I end up doing a lot of hiking and traveling, just because, I sort of resign myself to not doing much music while I'm here.
Which makes the trip coming up all the more exciting if you're, if it's
and which is,
musical. Go ahead.
Yeah. And which is what led to the, Even in Blackouts last record, because me and Gub were both in a situation where we were separated from everybody. So we started writing these songs like through email and stuff. And that's how that band got back together, was this sort of forced separation.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That album Romantico is all about that. Almost every single song is about him and I really wanting to be together with everybody, but the circumstances wouldn't allow it at the time.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I like Grohl on that. I thought that was great.
Gub wrote some great songs in that. He's a good songwriter, you know. I mean, he's another one that doesn't get a lot of credit, you know. He's like one of the first emo bands ever was in with Gage.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Gub's great. I mean, when I saw him at your it wasn't the birthday. It was the one before that. That was a house party though, if I remember correctly. At your place. It was before I think we went out to Baltimore maybe.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen Gub since that Screeching Weasel tour, and it was just like we just sat down and started shooting the shit. I mean, he's a totally cool guy. It's like he's just like falling right back into a conversation we left off 20 something years before.
Yeah, and then we all met again at the birthday, and that was just insanity. I mean, my God, I don't think I had seen so many people that I had worked with over the years in one place like that.
Yeah, I don't know how you did that. I mean, I would have been so stressed. I mean, because you're doing so much, you know, all at once. But if one little thing goes wrong, it tends to take over my thinking. So I don't know how you did not lose your mind during that. Not that anything really went wrong, but.
No, but I think that's where I kind of strive better. It's like I have to be a little bit overwhelmed in order to work at my top notch. Like,
that's good. That's good. A lot of people go the opposite direction.
Yeah. And I also like really figuring out the details of things. Like, it really was sort of a struggle and a difficult thing to figure out, like, that Weasel section and like who corresponded with who and getting all those musicians up on stage. It was really, and we didn't have any management. It was just the bands, you know, it was just all of us hanging out.
Yeah, I know.
So it was basically just me trusting everybody that it was just going to work out. And all I had to do was come up with like, like a plan and then just trust everyone to fulfill it.
Yeah, but you also had dealt with just the logistics of getting everyone out there and who's going to come and how many people. Someone I had talked to, I don't remember who it was. It was in person. I think it was out in California. They were saying that they had I remember who it was. Of course, now I can't remember his name. but he said he had contacted you about that, and it was sold out. I'm talking about your party, not the gig, the next
thing. Yeah.
And he said he just really wanted to try and, you know, get on it. And you just basically said, you got back to him and said, oh, by the way, it looks like one person won't be making it. So if you're still interested. And so it was just like, not overwhelmed. Like, basically, I'm embarrassed to admit, I might have just been like, dude, I'm sorry. I don't know if I can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I might be not giving myself enough credit here, but he just said that you just said, you know, dealt with him just like a person, and everything was, it seems like everything in your mind is just compartmentalized. Like, okay, I can deal with this, no problem, and not get overwhelmed.
Yeah. I think in those ways, I mean, it's weird to say it because sometimes honesty isn't always the best way. But in those situations, it was always, I think I discovered early on that it was just honesty. Like just saying, I don't have a space. And then, you know, something drops. I just fill it again. That to me was easier than to have to say no to people or you're like, I don't know.
That makes sense.
I'm good at the spreadsheet. And if someone drops off of it, you just fill someone else in the spot. It wasn't that, you know.
Okay.
And I don't know. It's and it was my house, so it was more like I didn't feel like I had to like fit to anyone else's guidelines. It was my own guidelines, you know.
right. No, that makes sense.
I mean, who knows if that's even true? Maybe someone didn't drop, and I just told them that because I was like, shit, one more person, that's fine.
Well, that could be. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, who knows? It turns out he ended up not going for whatever reason, but I just thought, I was like, that's pretty impressive, man. So,
well, yeah, those house shows are always special to me. Like, they're, you know, I don't know. I think it's important that it's special to everyone else. And we're just, in general, I mean, that's what punk is supposed to be about, is just people hanging out and talking. So it seems the perfect situation. Like, the fans, the bands just all hanging out at my, you know, at the house. I mean, we had the huge show at the Reggie's the next night, but to me, the ultimate thing was just hanging out at the house with everybody.
Yeah, yeah, and it went every bit as well as anyone could have hoped, I think. You know, yeah, everyone I've talked to just has awesome memories of that, and also the show the next night too. I mean, it was definitely a different vibe, because it was a show and not a party.
Yeah,
but if I remember, that was done out of necessity, correct? Because too many people wanted to go to the party.
It wasn't necessity. I had, in my conceiving of it, like within the you know, I started it a year ahead of time, and then in the conceiving of it, somewhere in there, I figured it was kind of unfair that we would have this many great people together and not have more people be able to see it.
Yes,
but my problem is that I was charging people more money than I wanted to get everyone there. Like the Mangies from Italy and, you know, the Lillingtons, and I had to pay for everyone's flights and stuff like that.
Right, right.
So the people at the house were paying a large amount of money. So I basically sent out a personal email to all those people that said, I want to have a cheaper Reggie shows the next night. Is anybody offended by that? Or, you know, everyone just wrote back and said, oh, that's cool, that's great. And then anyone who wanted to go to that show didn't have to pay for it. So
Okay, well, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah. So I think it was halfway through I realized it was kind of ridiculous to have all those, you know, just so many great people together and not have more people see it.
Yeah.
But I still wanted that night at the house to be special. So I didn't want to take it away from those people that were paying the bigger bucks.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, it worked out.
Yeah. So let me ask you this question, see where it goes. So our scene, and I say our scene from, you know, like Weasel and Queers and Groovy Ghoulies and all that, our scene undeniably became a popular phenomena in the underground. But do you feel this also means it has made a meaningful difference in the music, difference in music or in the world, is my question.
Well, I'm always surprised at how much bigger it is than I personally have ever seen. You know, I mean, we can't see everywhere at once, but everywhere it seems, you know, now everywhere I go, well, of course it's music related everywhere I go. When I'm playing, I'll meet music fans. So that kind of goes without saying, but, you mean, has it affected music,
I don't know what I mean. I guess it's something that I'm always sort of wondering about. And I don't know. I guess it's when you start I'm very philosophical in general, but looking at your life and the idea of what is important, what is meaningful, and does that make a difference? And I often wonder whether what we did. Ultimately, I feel like what we did, what Ben did, Joe did, what you did, what we all did has seriously affected the world, like in ways we can't even fathom.
I agree.
But yet I walk through the world and I have this job where no one knows this.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
It definitely affected people. The thing that gets me, I think, most about it is that at the time, none of us knew or none of us were going for anything like that. I shouldn't speak for everybody, but I'll be damned. I mean, the last thing I was thinking when I was recording stuff back in the 90s was that I'd be hearing feedback about it 20 years later. It just wasn't. In my brain. I mean, I would want to do something that would, I want to do it right, because just in case someone did hear it 20 years later.
Yeah.
But that I didn't expect it to become what it has. But I'm with you. I mean, there's, you know, I'll go to a show or something and no one knows who the hell I am. You know, it's strange. It's kind of a weird, it's affected a lot of people, but at the same time, we can be completely anonymous.
Yeah. Like, I mean, even in Japan, I'll hear a song on the radio. I go, oh, that's influenced by, you know, Blink-182, who was influenced by us, yes. You know, or, oh, that's like Pink, who, you know, the Lint from Operation Ivy wrote song. You know, it's all like connected in this weird way and in a huge effect on mainstream music. Like,
yeah,
it blows my mind.
Yeah, I see it as kind of a, but it seems to be invisible little kind of tendrils that go out that no one's really aware of or sees, you know. But yeah, I'm with you.
And ultimately, I just don't know what I love the life that I've lived, but there's some parts of me that sometimes questions that, like, that wants to scream me, you know? Like into the world.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I feel like maybe you and I are similar. That's not who we are, though.
No, not on this. Not. No, I agree. It's weird. It's something I don't often think about just because my mind starts to kind of whirl around.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of averse to, you know, I don't want to. You don't want to be egotistical, but you still want to know that what you did was, you know, I think once I started hearing positive feedback about some of the stuff I've done, that kind of woke something up in my brain where I was like, oh, okay, so this idiocy, there was something to it after all, and that I wasn't aware of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get something from that. And so it's, you know, I like hearing that.
I do too. I can't, I would never say I'm not one of those. I mean, I think I have humility in a way where I'm just not going to go out and start talking about myself. And I often don't really even say that I'm like, I don't think anybody here knows that I'm even in a band. And I was like that with the theater company too. I didn't, you know, unless someone asked me, I didn't say anything. But at the same time, if somebody asks, I'll talk all night about it. You know, I'm very proud of what I did, but I don't feel like I have that need to, I don't know, throw it out there. But part of me also says, you know, I secretly want to be respected.
Yeah, I think, well, everyone does. And it's funny that you say that you'll talk about it all night, because when someone asks me about it, if it's not, you know, if I'm not at a show or something, I almost am dismissive about it.
Really?
I almost, yeah, well, but then again, I mean, I was in a band called The Queers, and so that has sort of, and this was, you know, 20, God, what is it, almost 30 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
I started being very dismissive about it just in conversation, you know, because that sort of thing, get your ass kicked back then.
Yeah, so, that's true.
So I kind of, I've tended to always just sort of gloss over it, and if I'm talking about it to someone who you're in a bar or on the street or something like that, I definitely gloss over it because I just don't want to open up that. I'm the opposite of you. I won't talk about it all night, but only out of, I'm just not comfortable. You know, if it's someone that I don't feel is my sort of people.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I would say, I mean, just the caveat on that is I also get sick and tired of the same questions you hear over and over again, like, is Ben really an asshole? And, you know, so there are conversation enders for me.
True.
But I think, yeah, I'm maybe a little bit more willing than you to dig through that crap to get to some sort of heart of a conversation or something.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. The thing with questions like that, that come up a lot, I try and, you know, 20 years ago, someone would ask me where'd B-Face come from, the name. I was so sick of answering it. But over time, I was just like, you know what? Just because I've heard it 1,000 times, this person, it's their first time ever even asking it. So I got to be a little more respectful, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't, there, you know, but when someone asks you a question like, is Ben an asshole? How do you, I mean, that just opens up a fucking world of conversation. You can't really just say yes or no. I mean, well, I guess you can, but.
Well, you know, I think that's the thing where I maybe, like, once again, another caveat. I think my conversation that I want to have with people, I'll actually, people will walk away from me before I walk away from them. Yeah. Because I tend to want to talk about more complicated things than just a right. simple answer that they want. Like it happened a lot when I just clammed up about that whole thing that happened in the South by Southwest with Ben, because no one really wanted to know my opinion. They just wanted to know if I was on his side or on, you know, the women's side. There was no real conversation going to be had.
That's right.
So,
yes.
So I guess there are conversations that I would just stop because I realize, not because I don't want to talk about it. It's just because I realize they don't really want to know the complicated answer. They just want, you know, they want to know the fight.
Yeah. Which side are you on? And it's kind of the just sort of the gossipy level of conversation as opposed to, you know, what do you actually think about what happened and what's behind it and what's this and what's that? And people don't, they just want the quick snappy answer for a stupid question.
I think this is a good place to end it.
All right, good deal.
I didn't want this to go much longer than an hour, and we just reached an hour and 10, so.
Cool. Anything, any last thing you want to go over?
No, I mean, you know, this isn't really about your biography or my biography. So I feel a little bit bad that we didn't talk about all the bands that you were in, but people know. I think this was just more of just a conversation between you and me.
Yep. I'm good with that. Definitely, dude.
Yeah.
I got one question for you.
Oh, go for it. Yeah.
When's the next Mopes record coming out?
I would do it in a heartbeat. I've told Bappa that, you know, that's the thing right there. I mean, I'm willing to say it's very important that Vapid wants to do it. Like I could try to force him, but it wouldn't be a good product. So,
yep, I agree.
I feel like I'm just waiting, and I'll bring it up occasionally to him, but I feel like I'm just waiting for him to go, you know, in the Vapid way. Okay. You know,
yes, exactly. Which means... All right. Let's agree to wait for Vapid.
But we can nudge him a little bit here because I do have some instrumentals building up, and I think I've become a lot better of a songwriter since then. So.
Oh, good. See, that's what's it sucks. So none of us are in the same area, so it's not like we can ever. No two of us are going to get together and go over songs, which kind of sucks. But I'll be seeing him in June, so I'll be going out to Chicago, so I'll accidentally drop it a couple hints.
Yeah, please do, because I mean, there's definitely people that would want to put it out. So,
yeah. All right, sorry to bring that up.
No. I mean, don't be sorry at all. I would love it. I think we're due for something. But once again, I'm not. I don't get angry about it. I don't get upset about it. I'm not pushy on it. It's just one of those. I just really like the Mopes. So if it happens, it happens.
Same here, man. I'm with you on that one.
Cool. All right.
All right, John, thank you so much, dude.
All right, Chris, talk to you later.
You got it. All right, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 40 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests on Jughead's Basement. I have a Patreon, but I've put it on hold now for while I'm in Japan. I didn't feel right taking money from people while I was putting out stuff very infrequently, but you can still sign up on my Patreon. And it will sort of kick into action once I feel like I'm putting out enough material for it to be paid for by you, my audience. So thank you for any sort of support you can do. Really, what you can do best is to share on Facebook and Twitter and all those other social media things. Just share episodes that I have done in the past. While I continue working on the Smoking Popes one here while I'm in Japan, I'm working on it very, 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 very slowly, but it's going to be a pretty intense one. I had about a 2-hour conversation with every single member of Smoking Popes, So it's a lot of material to get through. It'll probably be a two-parter. So hopefully I'll get that out in a few months or this year. So that's it. Thanks a lot. This is the end of Jughead's Basement number 40. Fuck.